Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Tacticam. Tacticam is by far the easiest way to begin filming your hunts. Whether it's the budget-friendly Solo or the 4K 5.0, Tacticam has something for everyone. Check them out at tacticam.com. And, of course, this year we're also partnered with Spartan Forge. Hope you guys enjoyed that last episode with Bill from Spartan Forge. I think that kind of cleared it up as far as like how Spartan Forge works, how machine learning can be used for deer hunting, and how it doesn't replace scouting and time in the woods, but it does tell you if you know where the deer are or you've got a bead on some deer, when they're going to be active, and kind of where they're going to be while they're doing that. And you can go online to spartanforge.ai and use code BOWHUNTER to save 25%. And that should be opening up here very shortly. Next week, we will not be having an episode. I leave tomorrow or tonight for that elk hunting trip in Colorado. So I'll be out there. Can't wait to share that with you guys. I'm going to be out of service, whatever. I'll be doing as much as I can from the road on the way out and on the way back. So still scrambling, getting everything all ready. I've got my Tacticams charging up right now. Got the LR spotter going, as well as one of the 5.0s, and then I got one of the 5.0 wides pointing back at me. That's the way that I set those Tacticams up, and I like it for ease of use. You know, congrats to my buddy Mark. Shot that great Michigan buck decoying, of all things here in Michigan. I can't believe that this early in the season, but I mean, you know, congrats to him. And he won our Patreon package a while back and was able to capture it on that Tacticam Solo. So pretty pumped about that. Main camera was dead, and you know, so we had that attached to the stabilizer, and he was able to get it on camera and be able to show it. So again, congrats to him. Just did our Patreon giveaway for the last quarter, and so for those didn't see it on Instagram, I've contacted all the winners, but Spartan Forge was Cody Campo, Base Map Alex Plu. The Zingers was Josh Burns, and the Tacticam LR spotter is going to James Allen, so he's going to be winning one of those. And what Patreon is crowdfunding for creators. So basically, it covers all of the costs for this show, everything that we've got going on here on the show, from hosting to editing, the website, all of that stuff. It helps us to be able to do some of these hunts, to try out some of this gear, all that stuff. But we always give back, and so we do these big quarterly giveaways. And I'm trying to figure out a way to do it like a little bit more frequently, because I don't feel like we're doing enough for the Patreons. I really want to do more. And so I'm kind of soliciting ideas for giveaways right now. So we're thinking going to be a back tension release, maybe a set of arrows, and some packs. Again, you know, packs are one of the most, I guess, personal, expensive, you know, hard to try them all side by side before you buy them. So we're going to try to get as many of that stuff as you can. Thank you so much to Mike Kelly and Daniel Chamberlain. They're our newest Patreons, and we can't thank you enough. You can go to patreon.com/Bowhunter Chronicles podcast. You can sign up from our Instagram or bowhunterchronicles.com. If you want to be entered into that stuff, if you want to support the show, we really do appreciate it. We're partnered with some great companies. I mean, the guys from Zinger Fletchings, they just said, hey, you know, we can give you something to give away. So they give away some Fletchings. Spartan Forge, they give away one of their subscriptions, and that is proving to be one of my favorite things to check almost daily. Even if I'm not going out hunting, it's like, man, should I be hunting today? Super excited about that. So they give away one of those. We throw in as much as we can. And then, you know, Tacticam, I'm not sure what it is for the fourth quarter for Tacticam. I'll have to get with Rudy and check that out. But we're always trying to give back to the Patreons, because without, you know, your support, we couldn't do half of the stuff that we're doing. And we just can't thank you enough. But for everybody that's listening, this podcast is a little bit different for us. One of our patrons, but a good friend of ours, Tom Taylor, you know, he is big in our Marco Polo group, and he's just decided that he's done with social media, at least for a while, because it looks like everybody's successful. It looks like you need all of this gear to become successful. It looks like, you know, everybody is trying to pimp everything. You know, every post has a million tags on it. And, you know, with the podcast and with us and with our partners and all that stuff, you know, we're just as guilty as anybody else. And we just kind of talked through that process. But he has probably one of the more interesting upbringings up until maybe 5 years ago or so, he said. Maybe I'm getting that wrong, but it was quite recently he picked up a compound bow. He grew up shooting homemade self bows that his dad and his dad's friends were making, and then some, you know, custom bows and things like that. So his, where he's coming from and seeing this evolution is like talking to an old soul. And he has a very great, what I would say, great perspective on this. And he'll tell you, you know, don't listen to any of the hunting stuff. But I think this podcast is bigger than hunting. It kind of goes to like the family aspect, kind of why do you hunt? What are you doing it for? What's the purpose behind going out in the woods? And I think it's kind of a really great reset as we, you know, are getting into the heart of the season, as we're getting, you know, into the quote unquote October lull, and we're looking forward to the rut and spending more time in the woods. And I think this can kind of help maybe ground some people and let us appreciate that time in the woods. I'm definitely looking forward to my time in the mountains here coming up next week. And I really do appreciate all of you guys that listen and all the support, and, you know, everybody who's like, you know, good luck, it's going to be a great trip, etc. You know, the people that are following along, I really do appreciate that. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. And I really do hope you take something away from this episode. Thanks for listening. Hey, everybody, back with another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast. John's actually in the UP. He went up there hunting and is on his way back visiting a friend of his that's pretty sick up there. So he wasn't going to make it back for tonight's episode. But tonight's episode is, I don't know, I feel like it's kind of like a long time coming. A friend of ours, friend of the show, one of our Patreons, Tom Taylor, we met him like right when we started doing this at the Total Archery Challenge, and just kind of kept in touch and kept in touch and kept in touch. And he's come to Muskegon for work, you know, shot at the Bowman's Club, hung out, you know, shot with my daughter. And we're going to talk today about kind of like the state of social media and hunting and influencing and all of that sort of stuff. And so how are you doing tonight, Tom?
I'm good. I'm great. My family's healthy and it's hunting season and yeah, what more can you ask for, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, that I think is maybe the best part about the whole thing is that attitude that, you know, that's, I think that's what's so much lost is the family aspect in the hunting of today, where it's got to be antler size. It's got to be, you know, the coolest, newest gear, all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, we forget about, you know, family and bringing things up, you know, your kids up right, doing things right.
What's really important.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just for the gram or for, you know, we have to live up to this standard because, you know, that's what people want to see or whatever. And your upbringing, like, you know, we go through this often and say, you know, so how did you come up hunting? I think Tom's story of hunting and how he was brought up hunting is probably one of the most interesting, I don't know, scenarios, I guess. And so, Tom, how old are you? You got to be right about my age, a little older, a little younger. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think we're pretty close. I'm 38.
Okay. Yeah. So I just turned 40. So you're right there. But I mean, to say that Tom is an old soul is an understatement. So Tom, let's get into like how you were brought up hunting and like how your family did it, back in the day.
Right. So my dad got into hunting, I want to say he got into, he was always really an outdoorsman. My grandpa was into fishing. He kind of got into bow hunting and got real passionate about bow hunting. I would say his late teens, early 20s. And that, my dad's kind of a salt of the earth. Both sides of my family are that way. I come from salt of the earth people, hardworking people, but, yeah, my dad's a hardworking guy, working class guy, which most bow hunters are, most serious bow hunters are working class guys, you know, and, he got real interested in bow hunting early 20s, hunted with a compound for a little bit. And then he dove headfirst into the traditional world, which I, you know, back then a lot of people were still, compounds were just coming on the market. So, I don't think it was like, it's not like today, you know, you hear a guy say, I'm shooting traditional. It's like a definitive decision that guy's making to do that. Back then it was kind of like a lot of people still did that still. So it wasn't really that uncommon. I think he messed around with the new compounds a little bit, realized that wasn't for him. So he, you know, just went headfirst into the traditional world. He started making bows. When I was pretty young, I can remember, down in the basement, he had a full workshop, in the basement and then also up our barn, part of the hayloft he made into a workshop. And that was his passion, was building self bows. So I got into shooting at a really young age just because my dad was, so passionate about shooting traditional. And, you know, I was shooting, traditional bows. I mean, since I can remember, everybody starts out with one of those yellow plastic bows or whatever, but I just never progressed into anything else. You know, I was around all my dad's buddies were traditional guys. And they were hardcore guys. It actually took me, you know, into my adult years before I really realized the caliber of hunters I was hanging out with when I was younger. Not saying any of that rubbed off, but, you know, these guys were head over heels into it. And, just being outdoors, it didn't matter if you're shooting a compound or a traditional gear, which is mostly what all them shot. They did not give a crap. They were just, they were invested fully. And I was too, just because it was such a cool community to be around. And my dad took me to everything. He included me in everything. I was pretty fortunate to have a mother and father that, you know, supported that fully and gave us a lot of opportunities in the outdoors with stuff like that. That moved into my dad. He was very involved in the Michigan Longbow Association for a handful of years. He was president for, I think, a year or maybe two. I'm not really sure how many years it was there, but he was pretty heavily involved for a handful of years. And I was heavily involved because, you know, you're a young kid and you get the free range of the place to run around and you got all these targets to shoot at and you're flinging sticks and string and, you know, it's just, what more can you ask for? So that really fueled my fire. My mother was really heavy into the, you know, I don't know how much you know about this, Adam, but we used to do reenactments a lot, pre-1840, like fur trader reenactment. So I was the kid that, you know, for the few years I was on the football team, my football team was walking down Main Street in the parade, and I wasn't with them. I was in my buckskins and my dad's full 5.5 foot length bear skin hat. And that's what we were walking down the Main Street in, was because we did the reenactment in town, the pre-1840 reenactment. And that was our way of kind of showing everybody that, hey, there's an encampment going on down the road. Why don't you come check it out and see how people used to live back in the fur trader era, the French fur trader era. So that was my upbringing. And it fueled my passion for the outdoors 110%. That was definitely.
And so, like, when you would go hunting with these guys, like, what was the, you know, because you're a Michigan guy. I always think of, you know, Michigan hunters as, you know, the stereotypical bait pile hunters. And granted, my father-in-law really wasn't. That wasn't his style. That wasn't their style. So maybe that's not the case, but I think about, you know, his progression. And I mean, obviously you've had many a conversation or interaction with Frank, you know, his progression coming up. They obviously made the move over to, you know, compound bows and, you know, changing, but their tactics always stayed the same. So like when you hunted with your dad and his buddies and all of that, like what was their hunting style and how has that changed or evolved as you've grown up?
It's evolved a lot lately. But our style was pretty much, I don't know how to put this. You know, if it felt easy, you were probably doing something that you weren't supposed to be doing. You know, it was the hard road that was always chosen. I don't remember ever going on a guided hunt, and I was very fortunate to get to go on quite a few hunts with my dad. These guys were excellent hunters. They killed a lot of stuff. Now, when you're running around with traditional gear, in a new area with, I mean, I don't think it needs to be said, but you're definitely handicapping yourself. You know, you're making it harder for yourself, but that's a decision that most traditional guys decide to go with. But it was just, the tactic was, dig in, find sign, hunt as hard as you can, have as much fun as you can while you're doing it. And if you don't come home with something, so be it. You're going to laugh, have memories. And, it was never about, giant deer. It was always about the road you took to get there. It was never really about the inches that you got at the end, you know? And that stuck with me for a lot of years. Even when I kind of moved out of the house and I was still hunting with my recurve on my own, you know, I struggled pretty hard. And I, you know, a lot of the reason I never saw a big deer come by was because I was shot the first dang thing that stepped in front of me. You know, I got totes full of little racks, and I was happy with that. You know, that was just the upbringing I was brought up with. And you said something about baiting too. You know, the crew of guys that I was around, that I grew up around, I'd say 95% of them refused to hunt over bait, but that wasn't because of like some high moral or some moral high ground, you know, that they took. That was just, I just think that was the decision they were, you know, same as the decision. They never thought, you know, I'm shooting a longbow, I'm doing it the harder way, so therefore I'm better. You know, when I killed, that was never what it was. It was just like, here, I'm going to struggle doing this, and I enjoy struggling, so that's why I do this, you know. And it, I think that goes back to the baiting thing. I think, you know, a lot of guys that baited in Michigan, you know, back when our grandfathers were hunting, we had big, giant deer in northern Michigan. A lot of that started to go away, and a lot of guys started baiting, and they were realizing that was the only way they were seeing deer was seeing deer over bait. So I think that's a tactic that really took off there when times got real tough to kill stuff. So, you know, the guys I grew up with never faulted anybody for baiting or none of that. It was never even like a discussion that was being had. It wasn't like, oh, these guys are baiting, none of that stuff. It was just, you know, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to find them where they're living and try to kill them, you know?
So, I wanted to talk about, so the reason that I wanted to talk to Tom of all people to have this conversation is strictly for that reason. So coming up, you know, and it just wasn't like a normal thing to, you know, go, you know, in the world that we're in now, where it's like you want to try all this gear, you want to try this, you want to try that. I mean, they're making self bows, and you know, I think at one point in time you said, like, when you first started out hunting, like, you were like completely overbowed using 100-pound bows of your dad's or something, because, you know, that's what, yeah, all the other guys use.
But yeah, I mean, these guys were shooting, and this is very common knowledge in the traditional world. You know, back in that 70s, 80s, 90s era, guys were shooting heavy bows. Honestly, I think it's because guys were tougher back then, but guys were shooting heavy bows. I mean, my dad was shooting 70 to 85 pound bow. I think that cow elk he shot in Colorado with one of his self bows, that was an 85 or 89 pound longbow. Its nickname was the Mule, and it kicked like one. And yeah, they were heavy. Most guys don't do that anymore. You know, with aero technology now and aero tuning and stuff that we know, the information that we have now is, you know, those bows aren't needed. But yeah, my Achilles heel in the traditional route that I chose was definitely being overbowed. I struggled with that like nothing else. It created such a short draw habit. You know, back then, before social media or the internet or any of that stuff, you know, my dad and his buddies, they had zero tolerance for my short draw shenanigans. It was like, pull the thing back to anchor and let it go. What are you doing? You know, and it was such a frustrating thing to me. I didn't have the information I needed to get over that hurdle. And those guys weren't coaches, but form coaches, or they weren't Olympic shooters, they were just killers. And it was like, here, just put this arrow on there, pull it back and let it go, you know. And it was like, well, here I am, a 16-year-old kid trying to shoot a 78-pound 75-pound recurve, and no wonder I had issues, you know. So yeah, that was definitely an issue I had.
So in that vein, it would seem, because Tom has said you know, recently he's on a social media purge, so no Facebook, no Instagram, no nothing, for lack of a better term. And it seems like, you know, based on what you had just said there, it's kind of like a double-edged sword, because there is good information out there. It seems like you've taken away from that to kind of soothe some of your problems. But there's also the dark side to it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, double-edged sword's probably the best description of it, but it's white noise for sure. And if you don't know how to filter through it and get the information you need out of it, man, it's just going to distract you bad. I feel like, you know, when I was headed down, you got to recognize when you're headed down that distraction road too. And I felt it a little bit right before season. I probably should have did away with it before this last elk hunt this last year. My wife and I went on. Cause I had kind of felt the distraction setting in. I knew I wasn't paying attention to the things that I need to pay attention to. And, yeah, when we got back, you know, before whitetail season, I was just focused so hard on getting, you know, all of our whitetail stuff prepped and, making sure I had game plans for this and that. And I just knew that I needed to, you know, take a break from social media. Does that mean I'll be off of it forever? I have no idea. Could I be? Yes, absolutely. It doesn't faze me a bit not being attached to social media. It feels really good, actually. But, you know, there are some benefits to it. You know, it plugged me into some YouTube channels on, I think the guy's name, man, I'm going to botch this now, but I think it's Kaminsky, maybe, but he's an Olympic recurve shooter. Or a bare bow shooter, I think. He puts a lot of free information out there on YouTube. And that's the thing is some of these people, I think you gotta know who to listen to and what pertains or, you know, what information's helping you and what information is just white noise. And you gotta skip over it, get through it, ignore it, whatever you gotta do. But, you know, this guy puts out a ton of free information just purely to help people. He's not killing it in YouTube numbers. I'm sure he's got some, deals going on with his, professional shooting career, but, you know, he's put a lot of hard work into that, to get there, but he's putting out a ton of information for free.
So, define the term like white noise, like what does that mean to you, or what was it that was the issue?
Yeah, so white noise to me specifically would be, you know, let's say for instance, this guy that owns 200 acres of land in Michigan. I love following his stuff because, you know, he kills big deer and he has some good tips on there. And then the next thing you know, you're following this guy because he's killing more deer and he's got some food plot strategies or he's doing this or that. Next thing you know, you're like, man, I don't have 200 acres in Michigan. What am I doing? This is not like, I need to quit pretending that we're doing the same thing here. This guy has, you know, he's got this going on and good for him. I'm not faulting that person for working his butt off, getting that land management set up, like, you know, like the Mark Drury or the Drury's. That doesn't do me any good to follow along with their tactics and that kind of stuff as entertaining as it is. And, you know, as hard as they've worked to get all that set up, that is white noise to me. That is not going to help me get out of work at, you know, I'm going to bail out. I'm working 50, 60 hours during hunting season, which the last 15 years, that's been my case. I'm going to work six, seven days a week almost. I got one day I'm going to pull out of work early at 3:30. I'm going to hit the closest piece of public land next to me. I'm going to bail in there and try to make the best out of it that night. I'm not going to get that from Mark Drury's channel. Not knocking that, you know, but that's white noise. I need to get away from that. I need to take a step back. I need to focus on myself. I need to focus on the stuff that I know that's worked, the history that I have, you know, in the areas that I've been hunting, the things that I've done that's worked. and make my own mistakes, come up with my own tactics. And, you know, there are some chance, you know, like the Hunting Beast. Dan Infault puts a great stuff for that style of hunting. The guy that has worked his tail off to get 200 acres of hunting property and has now managed it with food plots and done all this work all season long, to hang his stands, cameras, know exactly where everything is. Dan Infault's style of hunting, it may not work for him, because Dan Infault's going to say, hey man, don't go into that tree and don't go into that spot, burn that spot out. Well, that guy's put all his time and effort into this one area. He's not going to go someplace else. You know, he wants to know how to hunt and manage that land properly. And, you know, that would be white noise for him a little bit. I guess that's the definition that's how I would describe the white noise that I'm talking about.
Okay. I can totally see that. I struggle with it myself, like from this perspective, from doing a podcast, because I feel like I have to, kind of be up on the things that are going on, definitely trying to put out information that, you know, helps people and is not only entertaining, but also beneficial or informational. But then there's the other side of it where, you know, I'm on there all the time. So I see people like that are doing the same thing that I'm doing, and it's, should I be doing more stuff? Should I be posting about this? I mean, like, you know, Tom's been over here to see, like, I say, like the resource that we have with the Bowman's Club and, you know, all the, you know, that sort of stuff, like messing with gear, tree stands, saddles. Like, I mean, my friends, like when I was like in high school or, you know, just out of high school, and I had different groups of friends, and some of them didn't hunt, I'd be like, look, come over. We've got bows. We've got tree stands. We've got basically a pole barn that's like Cabela's if you need something, to get other people into hunting and to kind of show them. And we've been doing that sort of thing forever. And it feels extremely disingenuous to like post about it for the sake of posting about it. You know, it's like,
right. Yeah. Like
putting your life on display for what, you know, but then exactly. On the other side of it is doing this and trying to, like I said, keep people apprised of the things that are happening and help people and introduce people to, hunters, hunting styles and things that they may not be familiar with, all the while learning, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I think you can really tell when somebody's genuine about the posts that they put on their social media page and when they're not. I think, you know, a vast majority of people can sniff that out pretty quick. You know, it's one thing to share your experiences, memories, and, you know, you just sharing that stuff for your family and friends. That's great stuff. You know, I've got family members since I've gotten off of social media here that have called me up worried about me, like, you know, cause they love seeing your posts come in so much, you know, and they're distant family members that you don't get to see that often anymore. And they're a little bit older. So when they don't see that those pictures come up, they're like, what's going on? You know, what is something happened? And they're genuinely concerned about you, cause they love following along with your life and seeing what cool stuff you're doing. And, you know, I think you can sniff that out pretty quick when you see somebody doing that, or when you see somebody post, when they post a picture of a deer they killed and then they tag every single product in the picture that had nothing to do, that they don't have any affiliation with or nothing to do with, you know, it's like, okay, so somebody's just looking for attention, you know. It's pretty easy to sniff that stuff out. It's one thing to, you know, if you are in it for a business and you're tagging some companies that, you know, if that's your gig and that's what you're doing and you're just, that's the route you're headed down, then do your thing. I'm not knocking anybody for doing it, but, you know, you can tell when somebody's in it for just sharing memories, trying to get more people interested in it, or if they're legitimately just trying to get more free stuff. There's a big difference there.
Yeah, I got, it's interesting when you talked about, like, you know, guys that, you know, put all their, you know, everything into this 200 acres and how Dan Infault feels about it. And, you know, kind of like the, what you were talking about on like trying to hunt, you know, find things that will help you hunt like your particular situations and, you know, saying that, you know, you're not going to hunt this way and that guy's not going to hunt this way, man, that's a conversation. Like, I feel like once a year, like it seems like it's just about ready to come to blows with Uncle Frank on like the pursuit of a larger caliber buck. You know, you say you got totes right. full of the small, small racks and
year and a half old deer. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. You know, that's what he does is he gets in there and he can kill deer. Well, he's having a hard time in the last couple of years, but he can locate deer. He can get on deer and, he takes so much offense to like trying to not necessarily change his hunting style, but just say, hey, what if we set up over here a little bit closer to where bigger deer might be? What's wrong with what I'm doing? It's like, I'm not trying to tell you. I mean, it like literally like once a year comes to like, and then it's like, oh yeah, we can't have this conversation. I forgot. And so it's, right. it's interesting, to think about because there are, you know, even so many people that are, I've met and I'm involved with, you know, I'm vested in like you, I like, you know, on the Marco Polo night, you were showing videos of your hunt and how you set up on that scrape and everything like that. And it's like, you know, you could have killed this wounded or injured like unicorn buck. And I'm thinking, man, if I had my longbow and I was going to make, you know, I feel like often you see that as, you know, and this would be on social media or whatever, like the free pass, right? So nobody says, boy, why'd you kill that 4-point or 3-point with the traditional bow? Like, it's like, oh, every deer with a traditional bow is a trophy. You know, you got to be super close. And it's like, man, that seems like so to pass on a small deer to any deer with a traditional bow to me seems like a huge pass. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that goes back to the greater point you were trying to make there where that whole conversation is one that needs to be had more. You know, social media is actually, I think this is one of the negatives to social media is it's created this false narrative that everybody's playing on an even playing field. That's one of the cool things about hunting is it is your own road to walk. You get to choose how you want to do it, what you're going to shoot. You know, there's a million and a half different avenues you can choose when it comes to this. Frank's been doing it one way for years and years and years, and it has obviously worked for him. He, you know, he may not be interested in doing, you know, trying a different style, just like the guy that owns the couple hundred acres in Iowa and has just put his sweat and blood into managing that farm to find big deer, probably thinks you're an absolute fool for going to public land in Michigan. You know, it's, you know, I had a coworker, and this was all in jest. And I understand that, like, I'm not taking this to heart or anything. He made a comment to me about, He's been out elk hunting a couple times now, and it's been with a guide. Nothing wrong with that. Like I say, I'm not here to judge anybody. If that's what you want to do, do your thing. But he's gone out there with a guide. The guy has no clue to actually how to actually find elk and hunt elk. He's just gone out with an outfitter. He drives him in a side by side out there, shoots a couple with his, you know, shoots one with his rifle each time he's gone. The elk showed up right where the outfitter told him it was going to show up, you know, and then he makes a comment to me like, I don't understand why you've been out there for 4 years and haven't 5 years and haven't killed one. You know, it's easy. And it's like, well, let's not pretend we're doing the same thing here, bud. Like, that's what you got to understand is like, if you're going to choose a hard road to go down and get mad because you're not killing the same thing some of these other people are killing for taking an easier road, it's like, well, maybe you're not prepared to go down the hard road yet. You know, maybe you're not really, maybe you really haven't asked yourself what you're doing out there and why you're doing it. And honestly, I think, you know, a lot of, this is something I see in a lot of adult onset hunters, or even younger guys now, that are getting into hunting, their family hasn't ever hunted. They didn't get into hunting from their parents or anything. They're getting into hunting because of social media and YouTube, which is great. Okay. There's some recruitment value there. But they haven't really asked themselves why they're doing it. They just know they're doing it because it's fun and cool. But when times get tough, and you got to really grind hard through a season, or you really, you know, just completely mess a season up thoroughly, are you going to keep hunting after that? Or are you just going to hang it up? You know, you got to ask yourself that. I mean, I would bet 75% influencers on Instagram, I bet you if you asked 75% of them why they actually really hunted, they probably would stumble around the answer and couldn't give you a solid reason. I think that's a question that people really, that should be the core question of what you're doing out there. And, you know, to your point about me passing deer up with the traditional gear, I just started hunting with a traditional bow this last year. I just felt like it was time for me to go back to my roots. I have some information. I've put a ton of work. I mean, I have shot hundreds of thousands of arrows this last year, before season. I wasn't 100% sure I was ready to go out west on our elk hunt, with my longbow yet. And by the time our elk hunt came around with, this last year, I knew completely that I was ready for it. That's a decision that I've made myself. Now, if I was, you know, so-and-so goes out there and kills one, you know, and shot it at 40 yards and I can't shoot that far with my longbow, what good does it do me to get all upset and, you know, want to ground tune my bow? Because, you know, that's something I see a lot. I see that like that jealousy thing on social media over and over. I see it with the guys I work with. I see it with some of my buddies. They're like, well, he shot it with a crossbow. And it's like, okay, that's his choice. You know, what's it to you? He shot it with a crossbow. You chose not to. That's your fault. You know, I don't get why you're so upset about that. So that's, you know, it's a decision you got to make. It's your own road. You got to walk down it the way you want to. You know, the playing field's not even.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that, because I don't think I've ever really looked at it from like that decision making standpoint. But as you were talking about that, and when you started in it on, talking about the guy in Iowa saying it's like crazy for you to, go out on public land. Like, why in the world would you do that? And I hear that a lot, you know,
mm-hmm. Like, yeah. And these guys probably got walls full of giant deer heads.
Oh, I was at my buddy's house and it's not Iowa, but you know, and we're over there last night and he's got like, there was like 12 deer on the wall in the living room, and then they're scattered throughout the house, and then like his rafters are just full of antlers, and they got all this farmland to hunt. And you know, those guys are like, why do you go out on public land? You know, like why? And he's told me about some spots that are around his house on public land, and he's like, why would I go out on public land? You know, when I've got all of this to hunt. But mm-hmm. One of the interesting things, like as I was like going through and like learning about that new Spartan Forge app, looking at, so there's a Intel section on there and it tells you like how many deer are in Michigan and, you know, how many hunters, all that stuff. But like one of the most stark statistics on there that I never really thought about. And like, when you say like, why do you hunt, or like what, you know, why are you out there, like to define yourself? Like, you know, you hear Dan Infall talk about like, he likes to go out and walk past everybody and, you know, everything's on a level playing field. Anybody could just go out there. So the total public land deer harvested in Michigan last year, it has these statistics on there, it was 42,130. Antler deer were 25,288, and antlerless was 16,842. And on private land, deer harvested was 321,548. Of 185,000 of those, almost 186,000 were antlered, and 135,600 were antlerless. So that's like pretty wild to me. Like,
right.
Because there's so much, I don't know how many acres there are in Michigan total.
Michigan's got a pile of it. Yeah. There's no excuse when it comes to the amount of land. I mean, the problem with it is, you know, it's in one area. I mean, if you're a Southern Michigan guy, you're going to struggle pretty hard. But yeah, there's a pile of it up north.
Well, it says 20% of Michigan is public land, 7.3 million acres. And I mean, that's just wild to me. Cause then like, I mean, I feel like that's like a pat on the back to me. I'm like, oh, I killed a buck on public land. You know, that's one of those, you know, very few. But I think like that, like you said, like you say often, like there's much easier ways to kill a deer, or, you know, in your case, you know, that you talk about is the elk, right. You know, there's much easier ways to do it. But I think that would go for me too, is like really enjoying like the suck, like the process. I think like Thursday night, I called you when I was coming out of the woods, and like, it was like 70 degrees, and then it started raining, and then it started raining harder. And then as soon as the sun went down, the thermals came and just sucked like all of the heat out of my body. And I'm sitting there in a tree, kind of like shivering just in my like merino top. And I was talking to people, and they're like, that sounds miserable. And I'm like, it was actually pretty awesome. Like thunderstorm rolling in, like, you know, it's like, I don't know. Like to me, it's like a sense of accomplishment, like to go out there and figure it out, you know, and people don't want to do that. They want the answer.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the other issues is, you know, a lot of guys are, you're talking about, you know, like I said before, you're talking about working class guys. They don't have a lot of time, you know, they're working with limited time, and they're going to try to put, you know, you've been taught your whole life to stack the odds in your favor. So it really goes against that when you start making some conscious decisions about now making it harder for yourself. You know, and I see a lot of guys, they just, you know, if you're going to go down the hard road with hunting, if you don't have a good attitude, if you can't, you know, get over some of that decision, you know, if you can't realize like, hey, I made this decision for myself, you know, it's going to beat you up. You know, you're going to get a couple bad sits in you, and you're going to be like, you know, I'm leasing some land next year, or, you know, you're going to start in, that's fine. You know, that if that's what you want to do, that's 100% fine. But I guess what I'm trying to say is like, if you're going to make the decision to do things the hard way, you better learn how to have a positive attitude about it and find the successes in it, or it's going to beat you up bad. And you're not going to want to hunt anymore. That's my fear with recruitment. You know, everybody says social media, and it does. It's true. Social media has a great recruitment value to it. When it comes to hunting and the outdoors. But I fear sometimes that is not long-term recruitment. I'm nervous that that's more short-term or part-time recruitment. I don't think that social media is really cranking out those diehard guys. I'm sure there's some getting through the cracks, don't get me wrong, but I just feel like when things get hard, you know, they want to go on that adventure elk hunt, you know, or some Western style hunting, or they want to go to Alaska bear hunting. Well, when it rains 7 days straight on them and everything is soaked and they're cold, they're probably not going to choose to go back and do that again. You know, where, you know, those diehard guys are going to dig their heels and they're going to go, okay, what did we learn here? What are we doing next time? How are we fixing some of this? What can we do to make it better? You know, and they're going to learn how, and they're going to know how to have fun on that trip. You know, it might suck the whole time, but these guys are going to come out of it laughing and they're going to tell stories about it forever. Instead of the story they tell when they get back is, man, I'll never do that again. That sucked. That was the worst thing ever, you know? So I'm going to ask you a question, Adam. So you're set, you called me the other night and it rained, your thermal screwed up. Now, did you sit down and did you write down or mentally make a list of what you learned and what things worked for you and what things didn't?
So I was like on my phone making notes as to like, I was checking the wind and looking to see where the deer were, why they went that way. I made all of the mental notes, and like the one key in what I told you, and it was just easier to call you than it was the text. It was that I need to trust my gut and go do the first time exactly what I think. And like, that's the struggle that I'm having is like that, you know, reading the hot sign or whatever. And in that case, that day, I don't think it would have really mattered because the thermals were screwed up and the wind was supposed to, the wind was completely wrong than what the forecast had said, but it was just because it was so hot and the rain wasn't quite there yet. And so when it switched and completely died and everything fell straight down. So there was nothing that I could do, and I needed to go. When I go in there to kill a deer, unless it's in the rut, I am going to have to be on the ground, basically in the middle of a grass field, and I'm going to need a stiff wind. It doesn't really matter where it's from.
So you made the comment, though, so there wasn't really much I could do because of the thermals. But have you figured out or have you put any thought into why the thermals did what they did? Because I would say that the majority of the time in the areas I know where you're hunting and where I'm hunting, it's kind of broken up great whitetail habitat. It's that broken up edge terrain. Mm-hmm. The features are changing. We're not hunting giant big woods or fence rows. You know, these are a lot of transition things. So you're going from hardwoods to fields to swamp to hardwoods to it's changing and moving around a lot. And what I've been finding the last couple of years is majority of the time, if the wind speed is going to be very low or calm, I almost always have to hunt a thermal feature. I cannot set up for the wind direction. The wind direction is never what it calls for. I always have to set up for a thermal feature, whether it's, you know, if it's going to be calm, you know, I'm going to be on the edge of a swamp. I know that that swamp's going to suck because that swamp's going to get sunlight all day long. That heat is going to start rising. It's going to suck my wind to it. So if I'm trying to kill deer with the wind in my face while the sun's up, and a lot of times it calms down at night, and that hot muck is going to suck my thermals into it when it calms down at night. I've been burned enough times where I know, like on a calm wind. So I almost wonder if the setup you're talking about, if you could have, was there a feature? Is there a thermal feature that you could have predicted going into that?
Yes and no. If I were to have done it that way, the answer would have been to not hunt that spot. because there is a big ditch that is the feature that would suck my thermals. But the deer were coming from, I can't hunt the other side of the ditch, and they were coming from the other side of the ditch. So my thermals would have been sucking into the ditch where the deer would have been crossing. So
gotcha.
But it's interesting
so you learn. I mean, that's what I'm saying, though. It's like, that's a success in my eyes that you took from that, is you now know in that spot what to do and what not to do.
Oh, yeah. And what's funny is, like, last year, like, exactly the same scenario when I killed that buck was, it was the wrong wind, but it was a 1 mile an hour wind. And the thermal, and there's a draft from, like, a power line where it's inevitable that it's going to be there. And that's what ended up saving me. And then that's what kept my win from that buck. And that was what I was going to ask you, though, is, so, like, you had said about, like, that trip to Alaska where everything was rainy and snowy and, like, you know, for all intents and purposes, miserable, and to come back with, like, a good attitude. How does one, if you were that new hunter, if you were that adult onset hunter, how do you, like, garner those skills of, like, being resilient or managing expectation, doing the best with what you have? Like, where does that come from?
I would just say by setting realistic expectations. You're not going to go to Alaska your first time around being a new hunter and you know, you're not going to go in there and kill stuff like Aaron Snyder, you know, or name any other guy that's a flat out killer that's been doing this whole life and has spent, you know, millions of hours hunting. You're just not, you need to have realistic expectations. And I think really taking a hard look at what those expectations were before you go, or are before you go, and you know, maybe even making a list or a mental list of, okay, if I even see a bear on this trip, or if I even see quote animal that I, you know, I'm looking for, or if we get one close call, I'll consider this a success. If we find sign in the areas, you know, that's a big hurdle right there, going into a new area, especially if you're going to go into an area, and I'm notorious for this and my wife kind of hates it. If somebody tells me about a spot, let's say they're like, oh yeah, we went to this place one time in Colorado and it was full of elk, I almost refuse to go there because at some point I feel like somebody's robbed me of something, you know. I don't, and I'm sure there's a lot of guys out there like this. They're like, I can't go there now, you know? So that hurdle of just, you know, scouting some place from the maps, getting out there to a brand new spot, brand new state, you'd never been there. You don't even know what the road looks like getting there. You don't know what the hike's going to look like. None of the terrain, nothing. And for you to be able to find sign in areas where you predicted or hoped that there would be sign, that is a giant win for your first time out there. I mean, that's a success in my eyes, and I don't care what anybody says, you know. That's a big hurdle to get over, you know, and I think that's the key to it, is just really having those realistic expectations and knowing that, you know, a lot of these people that you're seeing on social media, if that's how you got into it and this is your first time, that's that white noise I'm talking about. You know, this guy's killing something, this guy's killing something, man, this guy kills something every year. Well, you know, the playing field might not be even. That might be a guided hunt. He's went without outfitter for the last 10 years. They always kill something. Or this guy, yeah, it might be public, but he's got history in there. Or he has history going to new areas for the last 30 years of his life, and he really knows what he's looking for and knows how to get in there and do it. It takes a lot of time. You're just not going to be, you know, you're not going to have that wall full of animals your first year unless you go to Africa and buy them. You know, you're just gonna, you got to be patient, or you get, you know, or you get lucky, or I guess maybe if you're just a flat out killer and you know how to get it done. But, you know, for most of us, you're just going to have to grind and put the work in and find those successes, you know, and have realistic expectations.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of that has to be tempered a little bit. And I only say that because, like, you know, you've had the experiences to go out, you know, with your father and his buddies and, like, learn, like, growing up from somebody. So, you know, they, I mean, I guess on some level gave you a spot, or, you know, you learned,
right.
Maybe you learned along with them of, like, what to look for. And I was just thinking about, like, you know, my elk hunting experiences and, you know, and I almost put it into, like, forget about elk for a moment. Be, like you said, any animal, but let's talk about whitetail here. I feel that way, like, when I go scouting, like, when I go and look at a piece of property on the map, and then I go in there and I look at it and I say, oh, there was exactly what I expected to see there. Or I think, like, I've said it before on here, and I was trying to think back in, like, all the deer that I've killed and, you know, whatever I've killed with a bow, and mostly maybe because of, like, when you take off your vacation and blah, blah, blah. But, like, it's always, like, been rut. But I feel like that's where I can figure it out. Like, I think deer, like, whether I know that there's deer in the area or not, like bucks or whatever, here's a spot where they're going to be during the rut. If I sit here long enough, or if I, you know, sit in there a few days, right, I'll be able to figure it out. And I look at the same thing as scouting, but I guess I never really looked at it as, like, a success, like something to, like, hang my hat on. But I guess if I was new to hunting, I would, cause I think at least at this stage in the game, I feel like I'm, I guess when I go in and look at a spot where I think there's going to be something, I just expect it to be there because historically it has. But if I was a new hunter and I was going out and I was looking, like, you could definitely look at that as saying, okay, well, it's a success because you found the sign in a spot where you thought there would be sign. So I think that's a,
right,
that's a pretty good takeaway, especially for, like I say, that new hunter. There's a guy over in Ann Arbor that I've talked to a bunch of times, and he's an adult onset bow hunter trying to figure it out. And he was like, last year, I don't know if it was like he had never seen a deer, he'd never seen a deer on stand. And it's like, well, you know, did you get up in your tree quietly? You know, did you retrieve all of your gear when you got back to the truck? I mean, you got to take a win from something every time you go out and, you know, move forward from there. But I never really looked at it in terms of, like, the scouting thing, which I think is a really good insight.
Yeah. I mean, I would even argue that, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years and I still find success in just finding sign in the areas where I think there's going to be, you know, I don't think, cause some years you're just going to get beat up. You know, it's not going to go your way at all. And if the whole time you're just like, you know, I've got a close buddy that I work with, and he got on a lot of deer last year and he messed quite a few of them up. He had pretty similar year to as what, you know, my wife and I had. And you could see it in his face, and it was a rough year. Guy's been, he's got big deer on the wall. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to kill deer. He was pushing it. He was trying some new things. And I think, you know, instead of him stepping back and saying, okay, I'm doing some new stuff here, this is going to get hard for me. I think he just expected the same results, you know, as he's had before. And it beat him up pretty hard. You know, fortunately, the guy's a hardworking guy and he knows how to dig deep and pull himself out of a slump. But, you know, that saved him. But you know, and then I think once he kind of saw, like, okay, I did some things there that weren't normal. These are the things I need to change. These are what I did right. Moving on, you know. So he's a veteran hunter. I think even as a veteran hunter, you still got to find those successes, and those small successes, in my opinion, they're a win.
Yeah, I think
they just got to be.
So this year, with equipment, I was going through it the other day, and I think I would say like 90% of the gear that I'm using this year is brand new to me.
Right.
And like getting out and having those first couple sets and, you know, practicing with it at home, and then getting out in the woods and like all the stuff that I need to silence or that like I'm farting around with. And, you know, I haven't got my rhythm is like, I feel like that new hunter, you know, like to some degree, like, I'm like, Jesus, you know, this needs to, you know,
clank, drop my flashlight.
Yeah.
Gosh, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I needed that extra headlamp, Tom.
Right. Oh, that's funny.
But yeah, so I mean, like getting up the tree quietly, like all these little things that you know, that we tend to take for granted, or, you know, you listen to these podcasts, you see these influencers, these hunters, these guys, and, you know, there was something I saw it on social media or whatever. It was a meme, but it's like, we're comparing our everyday lives to someone else's highlight reel. And that's what's hard to, you know, you don't think about, you know, these guys that are, you know, that go in and, you know, they preach all of this stuff. You don't see all the times that they made the clank, that's made the mistake, that, you know, when it really burned them is when they decided that they weren't ever going to have that happen to them again.
Right.
And it takes that, sometimes that giant failure to make it really sink in. And it's just super frustrating. Like when you get to that point, cause it was just a series of clanks and bangs and this and that. And it probably took me 25 minutes to finally get set up. And I was like, this is so stupid. I'm like, there's no way.
That was your first set this year?
My second. That was my second one. But that was my first one.
With the new gear.
But it was my first one in the morning, in the dark.
Oh, okay.
So that was what was way different. When I went in the afternoon, in the daylight, it was not really a big deal, because it's a lot easier to be quiet because you can see where everything is and what, you know, potentially is going to hit or clank or bang. But in the dark, it was like, no. And then I picked a tree with like the most branches known to man. And then of course, when I got to hunting height, I stood up and hit my head on a branch like I always do. So I had to go back down and move my platform so that I was lower and just, you know, the things that you do right at the beginning of the year, when you forgot that you have to, like how high you are going to be off your platform or whatever.
Right. So what you're saying is I should take back my comment about your two flashlights. It sounds like you got into the exact situation where you needed two flashlights.
No, actually what happened is that it is from John Dudley. John Boersma was like, hey, you know, we got to use these little clip lights. They'll be great. And one of them had dead batteries, and I had the one still on my hat from the last hunt that I was on. And I took the other one out of my bino harness, put the batteries in it. I didn't want to lose it, so I just clipped it to my hat, so I knew I would put it back in there. But when I was sending out the polos, I did have two headlamps on, and that was excessive.
Yeah, that was funny. I'm like, what did you get into that you needed two headlamps? One pointed off at a 45-degree angle and the other one. Yeah, those little clip lights are actually pretty slick. That's usually what my wife and I walk in and out when, you know, when we're hiking and out, if we're hitting a trail and burning 2 or 3 miles or whatever in the dark out west. That's usually what we'll take with us, because it saves the battery in your headlamp, you know, and if you're going in the backcountry, you don't want to have to carry any more extra batteries than you have to. And they're dim enough to, they're bright enough to see the trail, but dim enough that you're not like spotlighting the side of the mountain. So they are pretty slick for some stuff, and they are lightweight for sure.
All right, Tom. So we always ask your bow setup, all that stuff as we're wrapping this up, but I wanted to get into the one controversial conversation, because I think it's very interesting. You know, we talk about like the influencers and all of this, and you had told me that when you were growing up, like your dad and the group of guys that you ran around with, they were not big Fred Bear fans. And no, you said that he may or may not have been like the first archery influencer. So how does that conversation go?
This is going to irritate a lot of people. There's a lot of guys in the traditional world are going to hate me for this. No, I don't have anything against Fred Bear. I was making the comment that when I was growing up, you know, I hung out with guys that built bows, made custom bows, and then the Bear bow was a production bow. You know, and it was just kind of like, it was a good shooting production bow, but you know, the guys I was hanging out with were about, supporting local bow makers. They knew a lot of these guys. They hunted. I mean, I grew up hunting with Jim Reynolds, who made, Thunderstick. He owned, I think it was Thunderstick. Now I'm going to get that name wrong, and I feel bad because Jim was an absolute close family friend. You know, we hunted, he was in the close knit group that my dad hung around with. I hunted with him a bunch. Dick Kerrigan, he made his own self bows. He didn't really sell a bunch of them, but, and then Jerry Brum and Rick Shepard, who started Great Northern Bow Hunting, which that's now changed hands a couple times, but they still build excellent bows. You know, to all them guys, the bear bow was just kind of it was a production bow, and it just didn't interest them a lot. They didn't dog anybody for shooting them or anything. I grew up, it was always a thing like, oh, you shoot traditional? Oh yeah, I got a Bear recurve. And everybody had a Bear recurve. And it's like, oh, cool. I remember my first Bear, you know, that was always, it was kind of that mindset you had towards it, but you know, Bear bows are great bows. Don't get me wrong. But Fred Bear, you know, he kind of was, you know, now when I look back on it, I made the comment he was the first real influencer. That's kind of what he was. I might be wrong here. I'm not like a history buff on bear archery by any means. But I don't think Fred made his own bows. So that's where that comment came from, was like, I didn't even make his own bows. You know, he's kind of just an social media influencer before social media was even a thing. But that being said, like we talked about before, double-edged sword, that guy's probably, you know, influenced, you know, more people than anybody to get into archery. You know, his legacy is still just as strong as it ever was. So there's something to be said about that.
Yeah, it was just interesting because you're like, Fred Bear, he's the, you know, he didn't even make his own bows. You
know? Yeah, it's definitely a different outlook on it. And it was something that I was just thrust into as a child. I never put much thought into it, you know, but,
yeah, I would think back, like, I guess it would be akin to like the guys that came back from like World War II or, you know, Vietnam or whatever. And like, you know, the hot rod or like the motorcycle culture, and those guys put their life and, you know, blood, sweat and tears into those cars and all that stuff. And then you have somebody that just, you know, races production race cars that somebody built for him, and it's like way different, you know?
That's a great comparison.
You'd be like, oh yeah, well, you know, you got a whole team, you know, you didn't build that yourself, you just drive it. So
right
kind of the same thing.
I mean, you know, it's got its, it, they have their place for sure. And it's a big one. And, you know, Bear Archery nowadays still, even, you know, I think as a company, I might be mistaken, but I think they're extremely involved in archery shoots and, shows. And I think Bear Archery is definitely one of the archery, companies that puts their money where their mouth is, type of thing, you know?
Well, I mean, even from like your perspective or that perspective, you know, of all of the companies from like the major players, like how many are still that vested in traditional archery?
Yeah.
I mean, not many. I mean, there are, and they have, you know, the, maybe like the Olympic style bows and the, you know, the, what are they? Oh, I don't forget what it is, but it's like ILF or whatever. You know, that style, but not like long bows and all that. I can think of like Martin off the top of my head, and it's about,
yeah, it's definitely, it's not the, you know, sexy brand that sells. It's not the sexy stuff that sells on the front of the magazine. You know, the newest, fastest long bow or compound is definitely, you know, so it's kind of funny when you step back and you know, that's what was crazy about it. When I started shooting a compound about, it's been 6 years, five or six years now. And actually up to 5 or 6 years ago, I had never even pulled back and shot a compound in my entire life. I remember when I went to the archery shop, I felt like I was cheating on somebody in my life when I didn't even know how to explain the feeling. Like when I picked I'm like, you know what? I'm going to get a compound because I'm really struggling with this recurve. And I just want to get in the woods and kill something. I don't have to deal with this giant hurdle that I'm trying to get over right now. And, I remember I shot the thing and, it needed, you know, the pins needed adjusted. So I shot it and the guy had it tuned up pretty good. It was way too short for me. The draw length was entirely too short. I mean, like 2.5 inches too short. The bow was too small for me. I got monkey arms. I got a really long draw. So my bow arm was bent like crazy, and a good bow tech would have pointed that out and been like, hey man, I don't think this is the bow for you, but you know, I think he was trying to get this bow out the door. But so yeah, shoot this thing. Okay. So go ahead and shoot another arrow. And I ripped the fletching, or I broke the knock, or I destroyed the first arrow with the second arrow. This is the first time I ever shot a compound in my entire life. And, he had to give me like a brief, you know, like, here, this is how you do it. And I'm like, okay. So I bust the first arrow, and he goes, okay, let me adjust the sight. So he adjusted it a little bit. And now I'm like, the second arrow is like 2 inches from the bullseye at 18 yards at this indoor range. And, he says, well, now let's see if you can put another one. Let's see how your group looks this time. So I shoot another one, wreck it again. And now, granted, I haven't even bought these arrows yet. These are arrows he's building for me. And, I haven't even paid for them yet. And he goes, okay, shoot in a different spot. You're not going to keep breaking arrows before you can pay for it. I said, okay. So he kind of looked at me and says, you never shot a compound before? I said, no, this is my first time, you know. I said, I shot traditional my whole life. He goes, yeah, you're shooting this great. He goes, I don't touch anything. You're ready to hunt. I'm like, oh, okay. So I come home. I shoot it a bunch. You know, I shoot it every night in the backyard for a couple weeks before season. I'm feeling pretty good. And I'm like, this thing's impossible to miss with. I've got all the confidence in the world. And I'm like, I am shooting the first thing that walks in front of me. I'm just ready to draw blood with this thing, you know. And so this little 6-point walks in front of me, perfect heart shot, 20 yards, perfect, done. Now my confidence is even higher. Week later, doe walks in front of me, I'm killing this thing. She's at 10 yards. I shoot six feet behind her rear end, behind her. And I'm like, what in the world did I do, you know? And I'm thinking, my arrow must not have been on my shelf right, or something mechanical failed on the bow. It must have been something mechanical. Well, I do it again to the next deer. I had realized that you can miss with these things. And I was, I wasn't even looking at the pins. I was instinctively aiming this thing, you know, which was way off, you know? So then it dawned on me what I was doing. I'm like, oh man, in the heat of the moment, I'm just going back to my roots, you know, and just instinctively aiming this thing. And I'm like, oh, okay, you can't mess with these still, you know? So that was pretty humbling. But, yeah, I don't know what the original point I was going to there, but yeah, it's kind of a funny story.
So what are you shooting now? Like what's your bow setup, and how do you, I guess for the listener, like how did you land on this specific setup going back? Cause this is I know this is a new bow for you this year. So how do you decide, you know, this is what you wanted, et cetera?
Yeah. So I actually, it was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be to decide, because I'd been out of the traditional world, like I said, for, quite a few years. And, I would say for the better part of 15, 20 years, I really hadn't been involved in the traditional world just because, I'd had so many of my dad's bows to just shoot that I didn't have the need to be involved in what was being sold out there and who was still making bows. So I really only knew of a handful of bow makers that I knew were still putting bows out. Some of them had a long wait to have a custom bow built, and I was just really wanting to get one quick, because I kind of just made the decision that, you know, hey, I'm jumping back into this. I'm going to shoot this thing a lot. I might not hunt with it this next year, but I'm really excited to get back into it. So years and years ago at a bow shoot, I shot. It was probably one of only a couple laminated bows that I had shot. There's a difference between what my dad built was a self bow. It's one piece of wood. The bow's carved out of one piece of wood. They can be very deadly in the right hands. They got a lot of hand shock. They're great. They can be great bows if they're built right. Laminated bows are thin strips of wood that are glued together and pressed in a form, and that's how they're built. They're not necessarily carved out of one piece of wood. And then the guys will shape them down and do what they need to do to get them the right poundage. Well, a laminated bow is, it's like, their performance value is they're a little bit quicker of a bow, I guess, in layman's terms. So there is some performance value there, depending on your hunting style. That can be a bit of a quicker bow. So I'm like, years and years ago, I shot this Black Widow longbow, and I'm like, holy cow, this thing's like a rocket. What is this thing, you know? That always stuck with me. I was just a kid when I shot that thing. That always stuck with me, that this bow is like a rocket. What is going on, you know? This is way different than this thumping piece of wood that my dad's, you know, got me carrying around. So that name stuck with me. I looked them up. Yeah, they're still making bows. They're actually very, very popular now. I think Aaron Snyder had a big part in that. He shot one for a while, so their name come back around, got real popular. But they had some stock bows that were absolutely beautiful. And they're pretty much already pre-built to the poundage, and they just need to cut the shelf and shape the grip the way that you want to. So I couldn't get on board with the big bulky takedown recurves that are super popular now, just because I grew up with those 70s style recurves and longbows. So I couldn't, they were just the ugliest thing in the world to me. I'm like, I can't shoot this giant block of wood with these limbs bolted on it. I can't do it. So I knew that I wanted a more 70s style bow. Black Widow had one in stock. They had it on sale, and so I called them up and I said, hey, can you make this, what's that thing draw, or what's the poundage at this draw length at 31.5 inches? And, you know, he said, well, it's 54 pounds. And I said, perfect. I said, can you, you know, get it built and shipped out to me? And they said, yep, we'll get it right to you. And it was pretty quick. So I had it quick. I got to shooting it right away. I absolutely love the thing. So it's a 64 inch, PLX is what Black Widow calls it. It's a It's their longbow. 55 pounds at my draw length, 31 and a half inches. I shoot off the shelf with it, and I shoot day six, full length, 32 and a half inch, day six shafts. There's 350 spine. I shoot a three fletch, five inch, or a three feather, five inch shield cut feather. And those are, where am I going from? Those are 100 grain outserts, the day six 100 grain outserts on the front. And I shoot 125 grain Magnus Stingers buzz cuts. The Magnus Stinger buzz cuts, I believe, is what they're called. They're the solid blade Magnus with the serrations on it, the two blade. Well, two blade with bleeders.
Okay. Yeah, it's a weird conversation to like some degree, because it's like, what sights are you using? What's your rest?
You know. Right. Yeah. You'd be surprised, actually. When you get into the traditional world, there are different rests. There's a lot of guys that shoot springing rests, weather rests, off the shelf. There's guys that they drill holes in the risers and make rests off melted fish line. You'd be amazed, actually, the customization that's going on some of these traditional bows. In a lot of people's head, they think, oh, yeah, there's that, you know, bear recurve, you string it up, you fling an arrow off it. But there's a lot going on. There's actually quite a bit going on there, and the world's pretty vast, actually.
So let's just, because you've seen me shoot a traditional bow. I probably need a clicker. So what is that? What does that do? How do you set one, et cetera, for people that aren't familiar with what it is?
Yeah, actually, I will say, Adam, for your first time ever shooting a traditional bow, you actually shoot it pretty dang good. In all honesty, I don't know as if you're even ready for a clicker, because that's where I was. I only say that because I was where you were with that short draw habit. Mm-hmm. I know what that is, and I can see it. And it's a hurdle that you have to get over mentally. And the clicker is a temporary fix for a little while, but if you haven't figured out how to beat it mentally, it's not really going to help you. You're just going to have the same struggle, but now you got this mechanical device you got to struggle through instead of, you know, mentally, internally struggling through it. So the clicker, the way I use it now, the way I used it before was the wrong way. It was 100% of the time, my way of getting to full draw. And now I have mentally overcome that. I can get to full draw every single time. No problem now. Now I have an issue with my release. I pluck the string pretty hard. So that clicker, it's a psycho trigger for me to activate my release. So I can get to full draw, no problem now, without the clicker. The problem when I go to release is I go pull through. I get into my back touching like I want. And then I actually, I mentally want to pluck that string and let the string actually go, like, I don't know, instead of getting to a certain point and just relaxing my fingers and letting it go on my own, I'm trying to force it to go when I want it to go. So I actually use that clicker now as a way to, I get into my back tension and I get to full draw before it even clicks. And then all I do is I make that last little motion. And I let that click, as I use that as a cycle trigger for me to just, so that I'm not anticipating the shot. So when it clicks, I know that's time, you know, for my fingers to release. And I get a lot cleaner release when I use it that way under pressure. I still practice without it in the backyard all the time, because it's good to practice through it mentally. And then I use it in times of high stress to check myself, you know?
Okay. Gotcha.
That's how I use it. Yeah.
So since you quit social media and we have nowhere for the listeners to follow you or look you up, what advice would you have to impart on the people that are just starting out, or, you know, like just like everybody else who's trying to improve as they go? What would your parting thoughts be?
Oh, geez. I'm an idiot. Don't listen to me or anything I say. You know, figure out your why. Why are you actually hunting? You know, are you doing it to get sponsorship deals with people, or are you doing it because you enjoy it? And, you know, maybe some of that stuff will come later because you're good at it. Why are you doing it?
Awesome, Tom. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. It's been fun, and we definitely have to do this in person one of these times.
Yeah,
sure. When we're together. But I appreciate it. Thanks.
No problem.
Spread out on a tiny island, that the task of tagging a whitetail would not be a big thing. But, as I've learned, no matter where I've been, whitetails can be damn tricky.
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.